Okay. Thank you very much for the invitation. It's lovely to be here. I would like to start with a little bit of mathematical prehistory. Bott periodicity. Bott proved a result about the topology of the infinite unitary group and the infinite orthogonal group. And it's a result about the homotopy groups of these. And so the first row here corresponds to the case of U infinity. And as you see, these homotopy groups repeat. And then the one below is for the orthogonal group. The true meaning of Bott periodicity was elucidated a couple of years later by when Atiyah introduced the notion of topological K-theory. Again, topological K-theory comes in two versions, complex K-theory that has a period of 2 and real K-theory that has a period of 8. And I will tell you later a little bit more about that. Bott periodicity is also very relevant to physics. And its simplest manifestation has to do with the theory of Clifford algebras and the fact that spinners in various dimensions behave differently. So if I look at spinners on an odd dimensional manifold, there's only one kind of spinners. And in an even dimensional manifold, they come in two chiralities. And this fact that between even and odd, it's different is very much related to the twofold periodicity of complex K theory. And there's a corresponding statement about real spinners that have. Finally, and most famously, K theory was shown to be relevant in the classification of topological insulators. So this is the original work is by Altland and Zirnbauer, and then that was clarified by Kitaev. And they showed that K-theory can be used to classify the different types of band structures in insulators of various dimensions. For example, the fact that there exist Z2 topological insulators in 2 and 3 dimensions is directly related to the occurrence of these Z2s in this bottom line here. Oh, and by the way, the top line should have started by a 0. I got it wrong. Let me tell you a little bit about K-theory. We won't really need to know what it is, but I just want to give you a couple of things. So just like cohomology, K-theory is a thing that, given a space, X assigns a sequence of abelian groups. And the statement of Bott periodicity, well, it's two statements, one for real K-theory, one for complex K-theory. Real K-theory is usually denoted K-O, and complex K-theory is denoted just by a K. And the statement is that these groups repeat with period 2 and 8, respectively, for any space. Now, there's an analog of K-theory, much more complicated, that goes under the name elliptic cohomology. And the slogan, this is not quite correct, but the slogan is that elliptic cohomology of a space is the K-theory of the loop space of X. So if X is a manifold, the loop space of X is the configuration space of strings on this manifold. One can say that, I mean, this is again a slogan, K-theory is to point particles like elliptic cohomology is to strings. You, of course, need to, I mean, you can make it a little bit more correct by saying that actually the loop space of X is not quite the configuration of space of strings, because a string, if I rotate the string, that's still the same string. So you need to add this little decoration to K-theory to make it S1 equivariant. And still, even then, that's not quite correct. This thing on the right, this K-theory of the loop space, you could think of as being some kind of low energy limit of the true thing, and the true thing being elliptic cohomology. If this was right, elliptic cohomology would be two periodic because it's a K-theory. But actually, this is not quite right, and the true periodicity of elliptic cohomology has been shown to be to involve this much more impressive number, 576. Okay, so this is just where I want to keep it right now. Now, I want to tell you today about some possible physical implications of this 576. And this has to do with abelian Chern-Simons theory. So Chern-Simons theory is a three-dimensional TQFT with a field which is a U1 connection, denoted A here, and an action which is written here in blue. And you can make a variant of that where you replace the U1 by an arbitrary torus, and then, so it's a torus with a metric. This matrix Kij is the metric on the torus, and now you have the form of the action. So at the classical level, you need to know, in order to write down this action, you need to know that matrix, Kij, this thing, which determines the metric on the torus. Mathematically, I can also rephrase that as saying that what you need is the information of a lattice. So T is my torus, little t is its Lie algebra. The kernel of this exponential map is this lattice of periods of the torus, and that lattice comes with a metric which is given by this matrix Kij. That's just an equivalent way of saying that you have the information of these Kijs. But what can happen is that two theories, even though given by different Lagrangians, end up being the same at the quantum level. So let me tell you a little bit what I mean by the same at the quantum level. Here, I mean, so if I have two theories, theory A and theory B, that are two three-dimensional TQFTs, I can talk about domain walls between theory A and theory B. Or in condensed matter physics parlance, that's going to be gapped domain walls. And if I have two domain walls, there is this operation that you can do, which is the operation of fusion. You take two domain walls and bring them together, and you get a new domain wall. And you can ask for D to be invertible with respect to that operation, meaning there's another defect. So D goes between A and B. There's another one that goes between B and A, such that if you fuse them, you get the trivial thing. You get the thing that's inexistent. And let me show you why, if there exists such an invertible defect, it is reasonable to call theories A and B equivalent. I mean, suppose I put theory A on a torus, and now I use this fact that I can replace, and I want to compute the partition function of A. Now I can replace this by that without altering anything, because that's what I define this word invertible to mean. Invertible means that if I put two of these, nothing happens. And then you sort of grow this thing on the other side, and eventually you end up with the partition function for theory B. And so these two theories are unable to distinguish this manifold. So here's a recap of what I said. So we have classical Chern-Simons theory, which is given by this lattice, but at the quantum level, they might become equivalent. And so this question of when two things are equivalent has been studied in the literature. So here are some invariants of the theory, like if I want to know when two such lambdas yield the same theory, I need to know the rank R, which is the dimension of my torus. That's also the central charge of the theory in if you think of it as a CFT. And then there is this discriminant group D, which is the group that classifies the possible charges of Wilson lines in my theory. And finally, there is this extra thing that has to do with encodes information about the braiding of Wilson lines. So this has been studied, but the interesting thing is that it has been studied by two groups of people. There's a paper from 10 years ago by Beloff and Moore where they say that really what you care about is the rank modulo 24. And there's a paper from 5 years ago by Kapusin and Saolina where they say, no, really what you want to remember is the rank on the nose. And if you look at what they actually did, what Beloff and Moore did is they put their theories on various manifolds, and they put them on all kinds of manifolds they could imagine, and put all kinds of Wilson lines they could imagine putting, and then try to see if they can distinguish their theories using that. And for theories whose rank is equal modulo 24, they were not able to come up with a single manifold that distinguishes them, and then they were like, well, if I can't distinguish these theories, they must be the same. And what Kapusin and Saolina did is they tried to write down examples of domain walls. So they did it by sort of the usual methods of like writing down a Lagrangian and like, so they tried to write down domain walls, and they were able to write down lots of domain walls, but if the ranks are different, they were totally unable to write down anything. And then they're like, well, we're unable to write down anything, therefore they must be inequivalent. So if you think of it, there's no contradiction. What Beloff and Moore do is they provide a lower bound, and what Kapusin and Saolina do, they provide an upper bound. They just conjecture independently that their bounds are the correct thing. But I'm going to give you today some evidence that possibly the answer might be strictly in between those two guesses and have to do with this big number that appeared in my title. Okay. So I told you a little bit about elliptic cohomology. I told you a little bit about Chern-Simons theory. Where's the connection? So I need to go back to K-theory and elliptic cohomology a little bit for that. So K-theory has periods 2, respectively 8, depending on if you do it the complex or the real version. And elliptic cohomology has period 576, also known as 24 times 24. And as I told you, Clifford algebras, and more specifically, the behavior of their representations in various dimensions is very related to K-theory. And this connection goes via the notion of spinners and spin structures on manifolds. So mathematically, the spin group is the double cover of the group SON, of the special orthogonal group. Physically, a spin structure is what one needs to put on a manifold in order for the Dirac equation to be well defined. And as you know, the Dirac equation is written in terms of gamma matrices, and the gamma matrices satisfy the Clifford algebra, thus establishing the connection. The connection between K-theory and spin structures is purely mathematical. So you might have heard of Poincaré duality. Poincaré duality is this fact about cohomology of manifolds. If I take a manifold and I look at its various cohomology groups, so the manifold is a dimension n and it has cohomology groups from dimension 0 up to dimension n, they're symmetric, like h0 and hn are the same thing, h1 and hn minus 1 are the same thing, and so on. But that doesn't hold for every manifold. It only holds for oriented manifolds. And the corresponding statement for K-theory only holds when the manifold is equipped to the spin structure. So K-theory satisfies this Poincaré duality when the manifold has a spin structure. There's also a direct connection between Clifford algebras and K-theory, which I guess dates back to the work of Atiyah Bot-Shapir and then was later elucidated by Karubi. If you classify the representations of the Clifford algebras and then mod out by those that admit an extra supersymmetry, you will find these groups as Z2, Z2, 0, Z, 0, 0, 0, Z that I showed you at the very beginning. So you can directly read off the K-theory groups from Clifford algebras. Now the amazing fact is that all that seems to have an analog in elliptic cohomology. So let me start by the spin group. The spin group has an analog which goes by the name string group. And so if you replace point particles by strings, more specifically heterotic superstrings that have supersymmetry only one chirality, and require that the corresponding Dirac equation on loop space, which is called the Dirac-Ramond operator, be well defined, then that forces your manifold to have a string structure. This Dirac equation on loop space will be well defined exactly when the manifold is string. And this statement about this Poincaré duality in elliptic cohomology and for string manifolds, that's a theorem, mathematical theorem due to Hopkins, Ando, and Resk. So we have this exact same analog, like spin is to K-theory as string is to elliptic cohomology. And then the field theory analog of the Clifford algebras, of the finite dimensional Clifford algebras, is the Majorana fermions. So the free Majorana fermion CFT in two dimensions. And indeed, the algebra satisfied by the Fourier modes of the Majorana fermions is just some infinite dimensional Clifford algebra. So it is some infinite dimensional version of the Clifford algebra. And then there was work by Stoltz and Teichner that tried to express elliptic cohomology in field theoretic terms where the Majorana fermions play a very prominent role. And then there's also work by myself and Chris Douglas, and later reworked by Bas Janssens, where we show a direct connection between the string group and the Majorana fermions, and I'll talk about that later in this talk, which is very, very analogous to the connection between Clifford algebras and spin groups. So it all looks like there's a very strong analogy between these two things. So K-theory, as I said, has period 2, respectively 8, and the Clifford algebras have a corresponding periodicity, which is expressed in this way. So this little equivalence sign is an equivalence relation called the Morita equivalence. I will talk about that later. And then you have that Clif n and Clif n plus 2 in the complex case, or Clif n plus 8, are equivalent in that sense. And that's the 2 and 8-fold periodicity of K-theory that reappears there. In elliptic cohomology, it's known that elliptic cohomology has this period, just like K-theory has. But it is only a conjecture that the Majorana fermions should have a corresponding periodicity. This is a conjecture which I make because of the analogy between these two pictures. So the statement is that if I take n fermions, or if I take n plus 24 squared fermions, that you get something equivalent where, OK, this is some equivalence relation that between two DCFTs, which I have formulated at the mathematical level of precision, but it is not completely clear to me what the exact physical meaning is. I'm going to make a guess later on, but we'll see. OK, this is a conjecture. So let me first tell you what the free fermions are. So Carroll-Majorana fermion, so if I put one fermion, that's the algebra that is satisfied, that's the commutation relations. And this is a chiral CFT with central charge 1/2. The thing which I denote fair n is just n fermions, where I have n flavors of fermions, and they commute mutually, they're mutually local, and the central charge is n over 2. So this is a free theory, free fermion theory. This equivalence relation is probably the following. So there is a duality between two-dimensional chiral CFTs and three-dimensional TQFTs, and I'm making the guess that two chiral CFTs, A and B, are equivalent in that sense if there is an invertible defect between the corresponding TQFTs. Okay, this is again the definition. In order for this to make sense, I mean, in order to understand the relation between this statement about free fermions and the earlier statement about Trentamon's theory, we need to know that they correspond to each other under this duality. So I don't know a name for the TQFT that corresponds to one Majorana fermion. But if I take two Majorana fermions, that's the same thing as a usual fermion, and like one that has psi and psi dagger, which are not the same. And then that has central charge 1 and is dual to Trentamon's theory for the gauge group U1, U1 at level 1. If I take two n fermions, that's U1 to the n, that's a torus of rank n. And if I take 576 fermions, then I get this torus of rank 288. So now if we recall this statement from my earlier slide about what the rank should be, I mean, there was this Beloff-Moore proposal saying the rank should be in Z mod 24, and there was this Kapustin-Saulina proposal saying that the rank should really be an integer. And so I'm going to make the guess that possibly the rank should be taken modulo 288. Okay. So where does that number 576 come from? I just told you elliptic homology satisfies this periodicity, but I just want to show you a little bit where this number comes from. So it comes from a computation. So this is the computation for K-theory. And so that's a computation that algebraic topologists love. And I will tell you a little bit about it, not very much. But so this thing, this picture here, is actually a piece of art. This is not a sketch on a piece of paper. This is actually a painting. And you can see like there's the little signature here on the bottom right. So Bob Bruner was like really, really proud of that. So let me tell you. You start with the space for which you want to compute K-theory. And here I'm doing the version for real K-theory. But there's an analogous version, simpler version for complex K-theory. And here I've taken the example where my space is one-point space. If my space was more complicated, you would need to know a cell complex decomposition of it, like, and depending how many cells you have, you would put corresponding number of dots there. Okay, then there's this thing called the Sinnert algebra, which is this finite dimensional algebra here. And then the procedure says that you should take a free resolution of this little dot by this Sinnert algebra, so this is what it looks like. And then finally what you do is you take each occurrence of this black little picture here in this big picture and replace it, each one of them, by a single dot down there and put it at the corresponding space, place, and you get exactly the answer of, oh, this should be KO, K theory of X. And so the way you read it is like that. If I take, here you have a single column, so that's going to be a Z, and here in this next column I have a single dot, that's this Z to here, in the next column I have a single dot, the next column is empty, that's a zero, the next column is like goes all the way to infinity, that's a Z, and so on. And so that's how you get the K-theory groups. And you can see from this computation, period 8 appears. So there's nothing that tells you a priori that this was going to be periodic. You just do the thing, see what you get, and you get period 8. So for elliptic homology, you do the same thing, except instead of this little Sinnert algebra, you're going to use this slightly bigger one. And you can imagine that's not the kind of thing that you want to do by hand. But if you do it, then instead of this picture, which gives you the K theory, you get something which is unbelievably complicated. And you just do it and do it and do it and do it, and then you notice that after 576, it just repeats. So this is where this number comes from. It comes from this thing. And I should give credit to Mark Mahowald here, who was the first one who actually did the computation. However, I take credit for creating this picture because I was the first one who actually took this thing and painstakingly typed it into LaTeX, and then also the first one who like had a paper that where this picture appeared. Anyways. Great, so I told you a little bit about K-theory and about elliptic cohomology and where these numbers 8 and 576 come from. But the easiest place where you see this periodicity is with Clifford algebras. And I want to tell you how one can directly, by doing some very easy finite dimensional algebra, see this number, period 8, appears. Okay, so the Clifford algebra on one generator has like a very simple algebra. So this is not an inner product. This is just like E is the generators of the algebra and E squared equals 1 is the relations. Cliff N is the same thing where I put N different generators and they anti-commute among each other. And you can also write it like that as a tensor product of various Cliff 1s, provided you're careful to impose that the EIs have fermion number 1. And the statement of Vought periodicity is this Morita equivalence, which I now want to tell you what Morita equivalence means. So I actually won't tell you exactly what it means, but I will tell you something which is enough for two algebras to be Morita equivalent. If I have an algebra A, then on another algebra, if I can show that this other algebra, this bigger algebra, is equivalent to matrices with entries in A, then that's enough to know that they're Morita equivalent. And in this specific case, what we want to show is that Cliff N plus 8, well, you, like the correct size ends up being 16, is the same thing as matrices of size 16 by 16 with entries in this smaller Clifford algebra. Okay. So this looks a little bit daunting, 16 by 16 matrices. How are we going to do that? But actually, you can just do it. So let me prove it for you, just like walk you through the steps. Okay, so this is the definitions, and this is the statement that we want to prove. And for doing that, it's useful to also introduce the negative Clifford algebras, which are defined just like these other ones, except you put a minus one, like the square of the generator is minus one. And I'm going to call the generators that square to plus one, I'm going to call them E, and the generators that square to minus one, I'm going to call them F. The relevance of these is that this Clifford algebra and the negative Clifford algebra, they're inverse to each other up to Morita equivalence. The statement is that if I take their tensor product, that's the same thing as the trivial algebra up to Morita equivalence. And well, I can say exactly what it is. It's going to be a 2x2 matrix algebra, which I told you a matrix algebra is the same thing as the trivial algebra in this case. And it's really easy. Here is the proof. You just do it. You just say E goes to this matrix, F goes to that matrix, and you check the relations. And E and F anti-commute in the way they should. So whereas I need a 2x2 matrix algebra to represent my Cliff 1 algebra, and you might expect a priori that you need a 4x4 matrix. You need 4x4 matrices to represent Cliff 1 times Cliff minus 1. This statement says that actually 2x2 matrix is enough, and it fills the whole matrix algebra. Now, here's another little lemma that I'm going to use in this proof, which is that if I take the algebra of quaternions, the algebra of Pauli matrices, H, and add an extra E that squares to 1, then that's the same thing as Cliff minus 3. And here's the mapping. You can just like check, this is like, these are eight-dimensional algebras, it's like easy to check everything. And there's a corresponding statement where the E's and the F's are exchanged. Okay, so that's my second and third little lemmas. So let's collect these lemmas that we have here on the side. Lemma 1, lemma 2, lemma 3. And now I can give you the proof. So what is it that we're trying to do? We start with the trivial algebra, and we go cliff 1, cliff 2, cliff 3, and then what we want to show is that after I do cliff 8, I'm back to a 16 by 16 matrix algebra, something which is equivalent to the trivial algebra. But because I have this inverse of cliff 1, which is given by cliff minus 1, I may as well go the other way around and show that they're going to meet halfway, namely that cliff 4 is the same thing as cliff minus 4. And then finally, I use lemmas 2 and 3 to be even more clever and to say, ah, if I put the quaternions here, I can close the circle in this particular way. So here, the red arrows mean add an extra E, and the blue arrows mean add an extra F. And they're inverse to each other up to Morita equivalence. And so I do red, 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 and then blue, red. But somehow, the fact that this circle closes is the proof that this is eighth periodic. So this is just very satisfying. Okay, so back to this main diagram. So now I want to tell you a little bit about this result of mine about the relationship between Majorana fermions and the string group. And I will also make sure to emphasize the analogy with the story on the other side, the K-theory story. Okay, what is the string group? So you start with the orthogonal group, and then there's this sequence of groups that you can form from the orthogonal group, the special orthogonal group, which has only one connected component, and then the spin group, which is a double cover, and then there's this next thing, the string group. So the first thing you do is you take the orthogonal group and replace it by something connected. And then you take SON, which is not simply connected, and you replace it by something simply connected. So replacing, so ON had non-trivial pi naught. Pi naught is a group of connected components. And I've replaced it by something that has trivial pi naught. And SON has non-trivial pi 1, a non-trivial fundamental group. And I replace it by something that has trivial pi 1. And if you remember this chart of homotopy groups from the very first slides, which was like Z2, Z2, 0, Z, so pi 2 is 0. So there's nothing that I need to do here. But you can take pi 3, which is Z, and you can, there is this operation in topology that will take a thing and remove a particular homotopy group. So you can remove pi 3, and then you get the string group. And it's a little bit unpleasant because it's some infinite dimensional thing, which is well defined up to homotopy. But this is the mathematical definition of the string group. So what I want to do right now is to give you a concrete realization of the string group involving the Majorana fermions, and thus establishing the connection between these two things. So again, we're going to start with the orthogonal group. And the orthogonal group acts on this chiral CFT by permuting the psi's. If I have an orthogonal matrix, I can like permute the psi's, and the relations are satisfied. Every element of ON, I can think of as a defect line in this CFT, where the fields are discontinuous and transform under that. So it's the same way as the way in which you build a non-trivial bundle. You take if I take a principal bundle, which is trivial, and I cut it somewhere, and then I twist it by some group element and I put it back together, I get a non-trivial bundle. You can do the same thing with the fields psi to get this defect, which is an invertible defect. And the theorem between myself and Chris Douglas, and later by Janssens, is that this thing here is a model for the string group. So let me walk you a little bit through what this is. So I take, so it's a pair G comma phi. G is just an element of ON, so there's nothing special about that. And I can view that as a defect, and then I can ask for what kind of fields can sit at the end of this defect. And one thing that you will notice is that if G is not connected to the identity in ON, then, one thing I should have said. Really, what I want to impose, I want this to be a group, so I want to put invertible, so phi has to be invertible. I should have put that here. If G is not connected to the identity, then there does not exist any invertible phis that I can put there. So that ensures for the fact that I don't see this other connected component of the orthogonal group. And then if I take a given G, which is connected to the identity, there's actually going to be two possible phis that I can put there, one on its parity reversal, which accounts for this double cover thing. And then finally, what is this phi? This phi is really, I mean, I say a field, really what I mean is a Hilbert space. You put a Hilbert space there, and this Hilbert space has the group of scalars acting on it, U1 acting on it, and this U1 somehow ensures that the pi3 goes away. Anyways, if you take a statement of this theorem, and so if I look at that and replace in this page every occurrence of fair n by the Clifford algebra, the finite dimensional Clifford algebra, so for example, here I would say the orthogonal group acts on the Clifford algebra. Yes, it does, by permuting the EIs, yes. And then if you replace the word defect by the word bimodule, so every element G induces a bimodule, so a bimodule is something which is both a left and a right representation of my Clifford algebra. And I can take the Clifford algebra itself as a trivial bimodule, like with its left action of itself and its right action of itself. Or I can twist the right action by the element G. So that's how you get a bimodule from an element G. And then if you take this statement here and replace phi by just a linear map, an isomorphism of bimodules, then you get something which formally looks exactly the same and then is a model for the spin group. So you see this analogy, which, going back to this general chart, indicates that really the way in which the string group and the Majorana fermions sit with respect to each other is the same as the way in which the spin group and the Clifford algebras sit with respect to each other. So I have shown you this analogy, and I told you about the analogy between the relationship between string group and elliptic homology and spin group and K-theory having to do with Poincaré duality. In both cases, it's the same statement. And finally, there is this analogy here due to the work of Stolz and Teichner. And so I think that overall, this is a fair amount of evidence that there should be some 576-fold periodicity of the Majorana fermions. This story that I gave you about it being interpreted in terms of some kind of defect walls between Chern-Simons theories is just a guess. It's my guess. So it's, I would say, an open question to try to find the exact physical meaning of this conjecture. Anyways, thank you.
Okay, time for questions or comments.
Yeah, I just mean something. I mean, a particular way of writing something isomorphic to the spin group. I mean, you might say the spin group is the double cover of SON, and that's another way of talking about the same group. That's really what I mean. Sorry, I don't mean the word model in the physical sense. I just mean a description of the spin group. Yeah.
So the spin group is finite dimensions.
Yes.
So then all that complicated field theory somehow is
finite dimensions. Yeah, so if you go back to this here. So if I look at the data that I have here, I have a g and a phi. My g is finite, lives in something finite dimensional, and my phi lives in something complicated. It's like it's a field. So that's where the infinite dimensionality comes from. If I take g to be like in this other world, in the Clifford algebra world, if I take g again to be in On and phi now to be a linear map within bimodules, well, bimodules are finite dimensional things, and the space of choices that I can pick my linear map from is again finite dimensional. So now it's finite dimensional, even though it looks formally the same. It's because of this here. If I replace field by linear map, I replace something infinite by something finite. So then you get something that, then you need to still compute it, but you get the spin group. Oh, I'm just saying there's an analogy. I'm saying if you take the same statement and do a search and replace for various words, and put instead of fermions, put Clifford algebras, and instead of defect, put bimodules, and instead of field, put linear map, then you would get another statement, which is also, and of course, most importantly, instead of string group, put spin group, then you get another statement, which is also a true mathematical statement. I'm not saying that one follows from the other. I'm just saying that you put them side by side, and they look the same.
Any other questions?
Sorry, because I arrived late, so maybe you said this in the talk, but when you call this a string group,
yes.
What's the connection with strings?
Ah, yes. So if you try to set up the quantum mechanics of strings moving on a manifold, okay, then you need to say what kind of strings, so then the specific type of strings, like some kind of heterotic superstrings. So then you might say, okay, so what is the Hilbert space of a string on a manifold? So first of all, you need to say, well, what is the configuration space of the string on the manifold? And that's going to be the loop space. The loop space is the configuration space. And then you think back to the case of like particle quantum mechanics, what is it that I did once I had my manifold, which is the configuration space, and I wanted to build the Hilbert space? Well, what you did is you took the spinner bundle and you looked at the Hilbert space of sections of the spinner bundle. Okay, so now we're going to do the same thing. We have a loop space, and then you write down a spinner bundle on this loop space, and you try to consider the Hilbert space of sections of that. But wait a moment. How do I know that there exists a spinner bundle on the loop space? And that's where you need the loop space to have a spin structure. And that doesn't come for free. Sometimes there is a spin structure, sometimes there isn't. And that was work of Killingback back in the 90s, where he showed that the loop space admits a spinner bundle, admits a spin structure, exactly when the underlying manifold, the finite dimensional manifold in which the loops live, admits a string structure. So a string structure is defined to be some principal bundle for this infinite dimensional string group. So, and then once you have this spinner bundle and loop space, then you can sort of formally write down everything. You write down the Dirac equation on that, and that decries the equations of motions of your string. But it's in this requirement that this loop space should have a spinner bundle that you need the string group.
There could be other signatures too.
So, I presented it as if it was all Euclidean signature. But if I go to the relevant slide, which is, this one. So there's this equivalence relation here, which I told you, I interpret that it means something about invertible defects within TQFTs. But really, that's a guess. But what there is a mathematical definition of the thing up there. So I have an actual mathematical definition of an equivalence relation between conformal field theories, which I'm trying to give a physical meaning. I mean, like, this is where I need the help of someone from, like, here in this audience. But if you look at the way the definition is given, it actually is given in a Lorentz signature setup. So, and it is given in the formalism of algebraic quantum field theory, which possibly only a minority of physicists appreciate. But anyways, this is the way in which I can write down something. And then I'm like, okay, well, I have this thing, then what does it mean? And it's a little bit the other way around from the usual. I mean, usually you have a physical system and you try to model it mathematically. And here, what I have is I have a mathematical definition, and I'm trying to extract some kind of physical meaning to it, and I'm a little bit making some guesses, I guess educated guesses, but based on what I can guess. So yes, it actually came from something in Lorentzian signature, which I could tell you a lot more about, but maybe not right now.
Is there some simple physical interpretation of the Morita equivalence of algebras?
Ah, the finite dimensional. So it means that the spectrum of representations are the same. If I have an algebra A and an algebra B, and they're Morita equivalent, it means that they're going to have the same representation theory. So that's what it means. That's actually not only a physical interpretation. That's actually a mathematical definition of what it means for two things to be Morita equivalent. So when we're talking about spinners on various manifolds of various dimensions, we're really talking about representations of the Clifford algebras. And the fact that these things behave differently with this periodicity is really on the nose what Morita equivalence means. It means that the representation theories are isomorphic.
Any more questions or comments? Okay.
Running back and forth.
Just sit here.
Just sit here. Oh, okay. Now he does have to run back and forth.
I'll throw it.
Yeah. So, I mean, you showed us this, you kill off pi 0, then you kill off pi 1, then you kill off pi 3. I don't know if it stops there, or is there something for membranes where you would kill off pi 4? And
yeah, so the relevant groups.
What's known about those?
Yeah, so the relevant groups are Z2, Z2, 0, Z, 0, 0, 0, Z, and then it repeats. So you kill the first Z2 and you get the special orthogonal group. You kill your second Z2, you get the spin group. Then you encounter a 0, so you don't need to do anything. Then you kill the Z and you get this thing called the string group. And it's a very natural question, like, well, the next one, okay, there's 0, 0, 0. The next one you kill is pi 7, which is again a Z, and you get something. And people have connected that to five brains in string theory, and they call it, guess what, the five brain group. So you can go on, and but I would say that as you go on, the actual physical meaning becomes more and more speculative, in the sense that, well, it's sort of like it's a natural continuation, but whether things are actually exactly like that is a bit open to interpretation, I would say. This is This is just about N free fermions.
Sigma models into some target space with some left moving fermions in the tangent bundle, right? Or something like that. And I guess all those sigma models can live at the boundary of the same topological field theory.
So.
I'm not sure that's.
Yeah, so.
100% true. But I'm wondering if somehow you're putting more structure in this than just the topological field theory for N fermions. If perhaps there is.
Yeah,
some sort of
the supersymmetric sigma models are exactly what Scholz and Teichner want to use to describe elliptic homology. So
right.
they say, they're like, OK, so how do I. They want a description of what it means to have the elliptic homology of a space. And they want a description which is written in terms of field theories.
Yes.
And then they also want particular examples of field theories to populate their definition. I mean, they don't want just an empty definition. And
yes.
So what they want is they want whenever I have a string manifold, they want to look at the supersymmetric sigma model with target in that string manifold, and they want this to represent an element of elliptic homology of actually, well, okay. Let me be actually more precise. I have a fiber bundle whose fibers are string manifolds over some base space, mm-hmm. and then they want to look at sigma models with values in this fiber bundle, and they want that sigma model to represent an element in the elliptic homology of the base space.
Yes.
So this is their vision for the physical meaning of elliptic homology. The free fermions is just this very small part of this whole picture where once you did that sigma model, and once you view it as a class on the base manifold, it's some kind of residual supersymmetry that remains from that operation, which is just, I mean, so they sorry, there's two things. One thing is, what is elliptic homology? And the other one is, how do I write elements of elliptic homology?
Yes.
And in order to say, what is elliptic homology, you don't need sigma models. You just need the free fermions. In order to say, how do you write elements of elliptic homology, you need the sigma models. Anyway, sorry, I'm being a bit confused, but I can tell you some more.
OK, so. Join us in the bistro for a little snack, and let's thank the speaker again.